Hey, welcome to the third episode of Primary Care Update. I'm Dr. Mark A. Bell, a family physician, a professor at UGA, and editor-in-chief of Essential Evidence Plus, which is an evidence-based online primary care reference. If you like what you hear on the podcast, please check out www.essentialevidenceplus.com. Primary Care Update is a summary of recent research that we think is relevant to primary care medicine, and with commentary by some expert primary care physicians. The opinions expressed are those of the commentators, and the podcast does not provide medical advice, and we don't endorse any products. If you're a primary care doc, be skeptical. Read the articles yourself. If you're a patient listening in, please talk to your primary care doctor about them. I'm joined today by my friends Dr. John Hickner, family doctor and editor of the Journal of Family Practice, and Dr. Henry Berry, professor of family medicine at Michigan State. Hey, guys.
Hi, how you doing? I'm feeling great today. This is John. Just got back from 2 days at the Grand Hotel on Mackinac Island, thanks to the two of you and Gary Ferencik. So thank you very much. It was marvelous.
Well, it was our pleasure. We were celebrating your retirement party as a chairman of the department at the University of Illinois, and we couldn't think of a nicer place for you and Val to spend a few days.
It was well deserved.
Thank you. Thank you.
So, Henry, you doing okay?
Yeah, I'm doing okay. I'm here in San Diego visiting my brother and his family, and we're having a lovely, relaxing visit.
Excellent. Hey, once in a while, people ask about other good podcasts, and I want to put a shout out for the American Family Physician Journals podcast from our good friend, Dr. Steve Brown, who's a faculty and directs the program at University of Arizona. He and his colleagues do a really fun, lively podcast every 2 weeks, accompanying one of the new issues of the journal, and I encourage you to check that out as well. So the first study today, we're going to talk about a few studies today. The first one is mine, and that is called Providing Procalcitonin Levels Did Not Reduce Antibiotic Exposure for Patients with Lower Respiratory Infections. We like to call this from our mentor, Rick Bucata, the Rick Bucata School of Title Writing, because it kind of covers it all. This was a study in New England Journal of Medicine, 2018, volume 379, page 236. So in adults coming to the ED with a lower respiratory infection, does procalcitonin, the biomarker, help us better target our antibiotics? And this was a randomized trial. This is the biggest study to date on this idea in the U.S. They had over 1,600 patients coming into the ED with a lower respiratory infection. About a third of them had an acute exacerbation of COPD. About a little over a third had an acute asthma exacerbation. A quarter had acute bronchitis. And about 20% had a final diagnosis of community-acquired pneumonia. They randomized them to either usual care or to getting an automatically drawn procalcitonin level and being told how to interpret it. So if it was less than 0.1, they were told strongly discourage using antibiotics. If it was 0.1 to 0.25, they were discouraged. If it was 0.25 to 0.5, they were recommending antibiotics. And if it was over 0.5, strongly recommending antibiotics. So the initial procalcitonin was actually less than 0.1 in the strongly discouraged for 80% of the patients. Yet about 60% still got an antibiotic. Overall, there was no difference in the percent given a prescription. Based on the statistical significance, it was 57% with procalcitonin, 62% in the usual care group. When you look at the subgroups, there actually were some subgroups that had pretty significant trends in favor of fewer antibiotics with the procalcitonin value, 37% versus 53% with acute bronchitis. These weren't statistically significant, but I'd argue that they actually are kind of clinically significant. And I think more study is needed on some subsets of patients. I mean, I think it's understandable that you'd be hesitant to not give an antibiotic to somebody with acute exacerbation of COPD or pneumonia that ends up in your ER. But I think it's a different question for something like acute bronchitis. What did you guys think?
Well, it's the emergency department. I think that's part of the problem for us because these are somewhat different patients than we see, although they're very similar. Other interventions for decrease in antibiotic use in the primary care office have frankly been much more effective than this. Feedback, education, a number of things have been somewhat helpful. And the rate of about 60% prescribing is so high. We're seeing much lower levels now, finally, in a lot of primary care offices with other interventions.
Yeah, and you mentioned Rick Bucata, and he likes to describe the phenomenon of antibiotic prescribing as analogous to feeding the bears. Basically, we have established a behavior that has a positive, perceived positive reward. And so what happens is that patients come back sooner, more frequently for antibiotics with higher levels of demands. And what happens when we stop feeding the bears? They turn on you. They get angry. They get upset. They decide to move their care someplace else or increase cost by getting a second acute care visit. You know, I think the issues that we run into is it's managing demand and expectations in ways that are thoughtful and allow patients to perhaps understand what's the expected course of their condition and when they should be thinking about using an antibiotic or some other therapy. And that is perhaps one of the ways that we might keep people much more happy.
You know, I think we do have some advantage as primary care docs that we do have that generally that continuity relationship. And I tend to think of this as a war, not a battle. And I don't know about you guys, but I have given a patient an antibiotic when I thought they really didn't need it because I thought they just really, really wanted it and wouldn't be happy. So I'll admit to that. You know, I think we all have done that. And yet at the same time, you try to work on them, educate them. I just got back from the General Practice Research on Infections Network meeting, which is the 20th time this group has met in Europe. And it's some really smart researchers. They do a lot of work on this stuff in Europe. I'm always inspired by what they do. And one of the big themes has been from their work that delayed prescriptions are potentially very helpful. They essentially cut the number of prescriptions filled in half or better. So you can go from 70% to 30% just by saying, you know, here's your prescription if you really want it, but don't fill it unless you feel worse or you're just not getting better after, you know, 5 or 6 more days, you know. And then if you think that's appropriate, obviously someone where you very strongly suspect pertussis or community-acquired pneumonia, that might not be appropriate. But when they're on the fence, I think this can be a great strategy. And it's something that is used a lot more in Europe than over here. So I think we could maybe learn from that. So Henry, it is time for the quiz. You want to take it away?
Sure. So you have a patient in front of you whose only medical problem is hypertension. That patient is seeing you for a routine follow-up and asks, hey doc, what's the proper blood pressure target, or words to that effect? Your reply is that it should be A, under 130 over 90, B, under 140 over 90, C, under 150 over 90. Stay tuned.
Okay. Be thinking about that, folks. We'll give you the answer at the end of the podcast. Next is John with an article. And I know, John, this is one of your favorite topics. I've heard you give some really good talks at our CME courses. By the way, we do have a continuing education course coming up in Cleveland. And I think it's October, 6th and 7th, something like that,
yes,
Friday and
that's
Saturday.
Correct. Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So if anyone last minute wants to come on to Cleveland and, you know, we'll be there doing some CME with our colleagues at the Cleveland Clinic. And we also have courses in the spring that we'll let you know about eventually. But John, tell us about this study on vitamin D supplementation.
Sure. In fact, I'll briefly discuss two meta-analyses regarding diabetes and vitamin D supplementation, and then I'd like to provide a short commentary on the current vitamin D craze from an evidence-based perspective. These meta-analyses are both by Mir Huzini and his or her colleagues. This first one is called Vitamin D Supplementation, Glycemic Control, and Insulin Resistance in Pre-Diabetics, a meta-analysis in the Journal of Endocrinology Society, 2018, May 25th edition, page 687. Now, this is one of several thousand randomized trials and meta-analyses of the effects of vitamin D on health and disease prevention. In this case, the authors wanted to determine if vitamin D supplementation prevents the development of diabetes in persons at an increased risk, as the title implies, meaning they were obese or had prediabetes. Believe it or not, they uncovered 28 trials representing nearly 4,000 participants and comparing control group to the vitamin D supplementation group. Indeed, there was a difference with an average decrease in A1C of 0.48. So they concluded that vitamin D supplementation may be an effective strategy in preventing diabetes. And I think the key here is may. That means it may not. And of course, there were no patient-oriented outcomes whatsoever. So we have no idea if this prevented cardiovascular disease, peripheral vascular disease, kidney disease, et cetera. So that remains an important and unanswered question. Now, the year before, that is last year, the same authors published a meta-analysis of vitamin D supplementation in patients with established diabetes. And they noticed, on average, a moderate, or I'd say modest, decrease in A1C of 0.3 that was using a minimum daily dose of 4,000 IUs. So here we have two disease-oriented outcome studies, both suggesting that there may be a little bit of an effect. Now, let me go on and talk a little bit about the what I call the vitamin D craze. These two studies are somewhat atypical, because they did show a slight effect, granted disease-oriented, but nearly all of several thousand randomized trials of vitamin D supplementation for a wide range of conditions, even bone health, cancer, cardiovascular disease, mental health, have been overwhelmingly negative. Where there is an evidence of a positive effect, like in this study, it's been mostly with acute asthma and acute respiratory infections, the effect size has been very small. So why have we become so fixated on vitamin D despite almost no evidence of effectiveness? Number one, an assay was developed to measure vitamin D about 20 years ago so we could measure it. Number two, one of the developers of the assay, Dr. Michael Hollick, promoted measuring vitamin D through aggressive marketing to physicians, and he was a very effective marketer. Vitamin D sales now are about $1 billion a year, and vitamin D testing, as you both know, are widespread, with many primary care doctors doing it on everybody that walks in the door. Number three, the normal range to the vitamin D assay was set improperly. That's something most people don't know. Well, what is the proper range? A recent study from Australia on the association between vitamin D levels and bone health suggests that 12 nanograms per ml is probably the appropriate cutoff, not 20 to 30, as we're currently using. There was an essay in New England Journal 2 years ago that discussed the proper way to set the normal range, also stating that the current range was not proper. But we really don't have time for that kind of an esoteric explanation. But the range is definitely wrong. So the normal range reported by labs is incorrect. And then finally, low vitamin D levels are associated with many chronic diseases, as we know. The problem is we have this association, which of course we know is not causal. So what to do now in the meantime? Personally, I'm waiting for the results of the very large randomized trial being done at Harvard on vitamin D prevention for cancer and cardiovascular disease, but we won't have those results for a few years yet. In the meantime, what do? I don't order any vitamin D levels. I tell my patients if they're concerned about their vitamin D, just go ahead and take it. It's cheap and has little harm for most people other than, by the way, kidney stones, Henry. So don't take that vitamin D.
We gotta give the folks the background on that.
Yeah, sorry. So during my trip here with visiting my brother, I unfortunately had to spend a day in an emergency department passing a kidney stone. So they're giving me a little gentle jab here. Yeah. So I'm fully recovered enough to know that, John, you made this comment that there are thousands of clinical trials of vitamin D.
Yes.
So I want to just nerd out just a little bit. So let's say that there are 2,000 randomized trials that are out there using sort of the standard statistical cutoffs of 5% thresholds where we say that's statistically significant. Just by chance alone, you would expect to have 100 randomized control trials out of that 2,000 that would show some positive result.
Good point, even if there is no positive result. So that's a great way to think about it. And yes, there have been well over 2,000 randomized trials. So this is just a lot of craziness. I first got interested in this when I moved to Cleveland Clinic in 2009, and everybody was checking vitamin D levels. And I thought, what the heck? I've never ordered a vitamin D level. And that piqued my interest. And we haven't progressed a lot in the last 10 years or so, but I think there's getting to be a more widespread understanding that testing and treating vitamin D levels and chasing them is of no benefit. The USPSTF does not recommend it. But habits change slowly, so we'll see what happens.
You know, it's interesting that you say that. Habits change very quickly sometimes for the wrong reasons, and this maybe is a good example of that. You know, it changed very quickly to order vitamin D. Now it's slowly we're saying, you know, wait a minute. Yeah, a lot of observational data, but no clinical trials. You know, I practiced I was there this morning at a safety net clinic, and last year I remember seeing a patient who had been evaluated for fatigue, and, you know, mild fatigue, probably mild dysthymia, depression. And the volunteer physician ordered vitamin D levels and then rechecked them and testosterone levels. And I'm thinking, really, that's part of the standard workup now? You know, so, and particularly when it's a safety net clinic, you know, let's do the simple, cheap things first. So anyway, yeah, I think great reminder. There may be something there in terms of the lowering the A1C a bit. Obviously, is that really important clinically? And I think we really do have to look for consistent evidence from these randomized trials and really from the well-designed ones. So I'm going to move on here away from vitamin D and toward aspirin. So Henry, I think you have a trial to talk about, the ARRIVE trial.
Yeah, but I'm going to do John one better. John did a twofer. I'm going to do a threefer. So
Can't wait.
All right.
So we got three relevant studies, all reaching a common set of conclusions related to aspirin for primary prevention. So the big question here is whether or not aspirin for primary prevention is more beneficial than harmful in cardiovascular disease prevention. Okay, so remember that primary prevention means that we are trying to prevent a first event in an individual who may be at high risk. And this is not questioning whether or not patients with known coronary artery disease need to be on aspirin or not. That's not a controversy. So we have several years of research, multiple meta-analyses, numerous guidelines, and yet this notion of primary prevention is a little bit concerning for a lot of our patients. So these researchers point out that most of the recommendations really ask the question for patients whose 10-year risk is more than 20% using some standard calculators such as a Framingham risk, and that the role for patients of intermediate risk is less clear. So this first paper is called the ARRIVE trial, published in Lancet just a few weeks ago. They used low-dose aspirin. In Europe, low dose is 100 milligrams per day, so they had roughly 13,000 patients. They had to be 55 years of age or older, or if they were a woman, they had to be 60 years of age or older, and using the usual risk factor stratification, age, sex, smoking status, lipid concentrations, blood pressure, if their baseline risk of having a coronary event was between 10 and 20% over 10 years, they got into the study. They excluded patients with diabetes. They also excluded patients who were at high risk for bleeding complications. They followed them over a period of 5 years and looked at how often did certain events take place. And it turns out that the composite of myocardial infarction, stroke, cardiovascular death, unstable angina, transient ischemic attacks was about the same, just around 4.5% in each group. The overall death rate was about the same in each group. The aspirin-treated patients had slightly more bleeding events. This was about 1% versus 0.5%, so really low rates, and very few had severe gastrointestinal bleeding. So this basically suggests that in an intermediate group of individuals, intermediate risk group of individuals, that low-dose aspirin probably confers more harm than benefit. Now, let me just segue over into the ESPRIT trial, which was published roughly at the same time in the New England Journal of Medicine. This was a group of 19,000-ish patients. These were elderly, 70 and older, okay, different group. If they were African-American or Hispanic, they would allow them to enter into the study if they were over 65. And in this group, and in this study, after about 5 years of follow-up, there was a higher overall death rate in the aspirin-treated group of patients, mostly from cancers. So the number needed to harm in that study was about 625. The third study, published in Lancet, was a pooled analysis from multiple randomized trials. And what they looked at was whether or not weight conferred any confounding information into this. And it turns out that sex, men and women, as well as weight, turned out to modify the effects of aspirin. So what do you make of all of this? Well, bottom line is that aspirin is no longer something we should consider as a one-size-fits-all, that we should be thinking about risk stratifying our patients. And for those individuals who are in the highest risk strata, that's the group that we probably should be thinking about use of aspirin. There's a great tool. It's called, it's at a website called www.aspiringuide.com. This is a tool from the Brigham and Women's Hospital at Harvard. And you can plug in patient characteristics, and it gives you both the potential benefits as well as the bleeding complications. That way you can actually engage into a shared decision-making exercise with your patients. John, comments?
Yeah, very, very interesting. Now, what you didn't present, Henry, was patients who have established vascular disease, who've had a myocardial infarction, et cetera. And I think you implied, though, that for those patients, there is randomized trial evidence showing benefit. It's for those that are in lower risk who have not yet had a vascular event for which aspirin appears to have little value.
Yeah, I mean, I'll add that I think a lot has changed in the last 20 or 30 years, you know, not just things like Facebook and Twitter and podcasts, but we are doing a much better job of controlling cardiovascular risk factors. Fewer people are smoking. Many more have their lipids, taking a statin. We can argue about the extent of benefit of primary prevention with statins, but there's probably some, particularly with these moderate risk folks. People are taking blood pressure medicines more reliably. It's not perfect, but I think overall, we're doing a lot of other things to mitigate cardiovascular risk. And so the residual risk that's left is smaller for aspirin to have an effect on. I think that's my theory about at least part of what's going on here.
Great thought.
So certainly the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force guideline that was just updated in 2016, it adds the risk nuances if you look closely at their recommendations. If you look at the evidence synthesis, it was based on 10 studies with 104,000 patients. These are just a couple of small studies that we've looked at. But when you incorporate the 30,000 individuals, that's a significant number of patients, and it may be worth going back and redoing those meta-analyses.
I think what we have to look at is focus more on recent studies. So I was actually in the room where it happens, as Hamilton said, for the USPSTF deliberations on the aspirin. And we spent the entire day deliberating. And normally we spend half a day, but for this one, a whole day. And when we got in, there was this big foam aspirin capsule about 8 inches across. And it said Aspirin Palooza 2016 or whatever. And yeah, nerds having fun in Washington, D.C. But there were a couple other things about that. So one was, I think the individual patient meta-analysis we were looking at by, I think it was Rothstein was the author. Anyway, the one you mentioned, which was huge, a lot of those studies were quite old. And so they were before the statin era, before when more people smoked and in countries where more people smoked. So I think we really need to say, okay, what do these more recent studies in the recent environment and context tell us? Because it's probably somewhat different from those older studies, which were more favorable. The other thing is the task force recommendation said you really ought to only take aspirin if you want to commit to it for 10 years or more. And that's because the reduction in cancer risk, colorectal cancer in particular, appeared to be real, but only appeared after 5 to 7 years. So you kind of have to continue taking it for a while to theoretically suppress those adenomas and prevent them from becoming cancer. So that would be my take on that. But Henry, great summary, some really good studies. Thanks. Are you ready to give us the quiz answer?
Okay, just to summarize, your patient whose only medical problem is hypertension is in for a routine follow-up and wants to know what's the proper blood pressure target. And your options are A, less than 130 over 90, B, less than 140 over 90, C, less than 150 over 90.
I smell another trick question.
Henry.
Well, you know, the answer, it's like the same answer to all important questions in life. It's the same answer. It depends. In this case, it depends on A, whose guideline do you believe or trust, but probably more importantly, on the risk stratification and the age of the patient. So the 2014 National Heart Lung Blood Institute guideline that was paneled by actually the last NIH guideline that they ever decided that they would embark on. This was a guideline panel that only looked at clinical trial data, and using clinical trial data for outcomes established a threshold of 140 over 90, unless you are over the age of 60, in which case they said, you know, a blood pressure of 150 over 90 would be a reasonable target. So the American College of Cardiology, American Heart Association guideline basically said that the target should be 130 over 80 for pretty much everybody, with one exception. If you have an individual who has no cardiovascular disease and whose 10-year risk of a cardiovascular event is less than 10%, then you can liberalize the blood pressure to 140 over 90. So this is a very nuanced area. We need to be aware of some of the conflicting information from the various guidelines, but the primary issue is we need to risk stratify our patients.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, it depends is a, unfortunately, all too common an answer, but that's why we haven't been replaced yet by computers and algorithms, at least not completely. And I think that nuance was lost. I think the news that came out and that ACC guideline panel chaired by cardiologists, in particular, the cardiologist who ran the SPRINT trial. So there's a little conflict of interest there, at least intellectually. The message came out as everybody needs to be 130 over 80. And that's not true. I mean, my cardiovascular risk, my 10-year risk is around 7%. I take medicine for hypertension. So my target should be 140 over 90 because I'm not over that 10% risk, no known heart disease. But I think a lot of docs got the message of 130 over 80 for everyone. And I think there are some downsides. The folks who were in the group randomized to the lower target in the SPRINT trial, they ended up taking on average one more medication. They had a higher risk of acute kidney problems, and they had some increased risk of hypokalemia, increased risk of syncope. So, you know, there were some harms as well as some apparent benefits. And I think it's important to remember, too, in the SPRINT trial, their average 10-year cardiovascular risk was about, I think, 12 or 13%. It was very high. And a lot of them had known cardiovascular disease. So this was, it's a case of, I think, the message has been extended too broadly. And I think we need to, as you say, individualize, look at the patient in front of us. You know, is this somebody who would be at risk if we tried to put them on too many medications? Are they doing well? So really nice summary, Henry. Thank you.
Although it's a topic for another day, I just want to put in a plug for appropriate measurement of blood pressure, both in the office and the new recommendation from USPSTF to get a bunch of home blood pressure readings, I think is really important to sort out who really has sustained hypertension and who doesn't.
Yeah, and the SPRINT folks were very, very slow and careful in how they measured the blood pressure in the office, and they got measurements that probably were at least 10 millimeters lower than you would get doing it the way we typically do it in our offices. And so I think if we're going to try to match that target, we need to match how they measured the blood pressure. Otherwise, we risk driving the pressure too low, particularly a problem in some of our older patients or patients who are more vulnerable. So anyway, great point, Henry. We're going to wrap up today. Thanks, guys, for joining me. Enjoyed the discussion. And we are hitting 30 minutes almost exactly. So I think we're getting a little better on our timing. And I'll talk to you guys in a couple of weeks.
Very good. Thank you.
Take care.